dear elders. Today's topic is the ascent of Sri Aurobindo. And to speak about this ascent of Sri Aurobindo seems to me as audacious as the salt doll which went to measure the ocean. But this audacity of my mind I lay at the feet of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo and pray to be forgiven. And after the talk yesterday, some persons approached me and said it was a new concept, very difficult to grasp, perhaps even more difficult to accept. Well, obviously so, because Sri Aurobindo goes basically against the gangetic current of humanity's thinking which has been there for the past thousands of years. He is one man who has come down to change the course of humanity's thinking. And obviously all the thinking that is there in our blood, the beliefs that are really running in our veins, especially the beliefs of moksha and liberation, especially the ideas of this body not being the right vehicle, all the negative feelings about the matter, he is one person who has really come to block these concepts and divert this flow, perennial flow that has come down in towards a new thinking. So it is very difficult indeed to accept him or to understand him and to accept him. But basically, Sri Aurobindo's life has been one of paradoxes. It is indeed a great adventure of consciousness and joy. It is a great phenomenon and yet full of paradoxes. That is what we see in the life of Sri Aurobindo. We do have some details of his external life. We know exactly the phases of his external works. And yet, it is impossible to fathom, to understand the meaning of these external rhythms. In fact, about his inner life, nobody can gauge. And that is why he had told his biographers not to attempt to write any biography. Because he said, my life has not been on the surface for men to see. It has been a completely inner life. But at the same time we see that how much of his external life do we understand? Not much. Because those people who have lived with him very closely during his political days, during his days in Gujarat, in Baroda, during even his days in England, have vowed and watched on one thing, that he was an impersonal person. His personality was one of impersonality. They said that always his eyes looked beyond. It was as if he was looking through the third eye of Shiva towards this world. He was looking to the future and to the past of the world. He was looking at the world and yet he was not in it. He was in the thickest of politics, Indian freedom movement. He was in the thickest of education policies. He was in the service of Baroda. And yet people have vouched that he never belonged to this world. As one of his disciples calls him, his was a noumenal personality, they say. As against a phenomenal personality, he says, disturbing those is a noumenal personality. So that is how I say that even his external life we cannot understand. A person who was a skeptic, he himself says to begin with he was a skeptic, but he ends up in realizing the Supreme Brahman. A person who says he was only a poet and who wrote his first poem under the influence of Shelley, the great poem The Cloud, and that person ends up giving us the greatest mantra of the future, Savitri. A person who says, I am not a philosopher, he set upon himself to change the entire thinking of the world. A person who did not want to do yoga has given to humanity the integral yoga, which is the path of tomorrow, which is the only path of salvation for the earth. And therefore, we see all these paradoxes in his life, even the external life I mean. So what about his inner life? And a person who was agnostic has really brought down the greatest form of the Divine Shakti, the Divine Mother, and has given to humanity the most beautiful form of bhakti and devotion. So all those of you who say we cannot understand Sri Aurobindo, it's no wonder, because his external, not in his internal life, can be understood by us. But today what we are going to see is purely drawn out from his own writings. So that is why I take the courage of putting forward to you some of these points of his internal life. But mind you, behind the external life, there was a parallel current of his inner life, which was not seen or understood by others. But thanks to a lot of correspondence, some letters, sometimes he has spoken to his disciples, and sometimes to the errors committed by his biographers, Sri Aurobindo has come out with a lot of his own inner secrets, which we have put forward and seen that there is a rhythm in his life, that there is a constant ascent of his consciousness, that there is a constant growth. Because we see in his life basically four periods, that of England, that of Baroda, that of Calcutta, and that of Pondicherry. So these four phases of his life are really four really different stages of his realizations. So they are not just places, or they are not just periods, but they have been phases of realization. And that is what we see the most interesting point of his life. Every time he passed a phase of his life, he really went to the next phase of his life for a higher realization. It was not changing places because of a job. Externally we may see from Baroda he went to Calcutta and became the president of the National College and the principal of the National College. No, there was a deeper meaning. There was a deeper struggle always. So there was this kind of a double parallel life that was Sri Aurobindo's life. And at the same time we see, unlike our lives which are really motivated, changed by circumstances, Sri Aurobindo's was a life in which he had complete control over his circumstances. In fact, all the decisions he took were taken by himself, except the most famous one, from Calcutta when he comes away to Chandranagar, he was given the Adesh to go to Chandranagar. Apart from that decision, all the decisions have been his own. That is only goes to show that he was really the master of himself and his circumstances. So these were the external details. But now let us come to the different phases of his life. And his biographers and people close to him have noted one more thing, which I would like to mention before I go further. That each time, he was always ahead of his period. Say, when he was in the family life, he was not stuck to the family life. His framework was never a family life. It was always the life of nation. He always worked for the independence of the country. But at the same time, he was not a chauvinist for the independence of the country of India. He always looked forward to the independence of humanity, to the liberation of humanity. And when he thought about the liberation of humanity, that framework also was not sufficient. He always thought of the transformation of the humanity's future. So this was the time of life he led, never stuck to small framework of family or of caste or of nation or method. Because his boundaries always expanded. In each phase, his frontiers were towards the infinite. So that is why we say that in one of his letters, when he had married Mrinalini, he writes to her, a very beautiful quotation is here. He says, "I am afraid I shall never be good for much in the way of domestic virtues. I have tried very ineffectively to do some part of my duty as a son, a brother, and a husband. But there is something too strong in me which forces me to subordinate everything else to it." So see, he says everything of this life is subordinated to something else, and that something else we will see as we go along the way. So this was the rhythm of his life. He always worked for a greater frontier. And then, as I just now mentioned, there were four phases of his external life. And I chose to call them just for the sake of really clinching the issue. The phase of England could be called the phase of incubation. The phase of Baroda, the phase of initiation. And the phase of Calcutta and Chandranagar, phase of realizations. And that of Pondicherry, fulfillment or transformation or manifestation, whichever the word. So you see, there is a distinct growth even in these phases. There was one initiation, incubation, initiation, realization, manifestation. This is the rhythm in his external life as well as the rhythm in his internal life. So if you remember these four phases, in fact I'm going to really study these four phases and show you parallelly how the external and the internal go hand in hand. So to come to that, the first phase is England. Well, of course, before that, he went to Darjeeling for his primary school. But at the age of 7, as all of you know, he was taken to England. Well, I'm not here giving the biographical details of his life, but only the phases, and I'll highlight only those things that really are purposeful and needed for our talk today. In England, what did he do? Basically, it was his intellectual education. As I said, it was a period of incubation. He really caught the essence of Western culture. He read profusely literature, history, and poetry. And especially, he learned languages and read the original of Homer, Dante, Goethe, Aristophanes. So all the originals he had really learned, really catching or really imbibing the essence of the Western culture. And amongst poets, he liked most the Romantics. And obviously the reason is, as he himself tells us in his future poetry, The romantics were the first persons, were the first poets who caught spirituality in their poetry. And this man, this young poet, was already attracted to the romantics because within him there was a preparation of the spiritual poetry that was to come later on in the form of Savitri. And here, may I tell you, at the age of 10, his first poem called The Light was published in Fox's magazine. Remember, he was just 10. And well, I'll not read out the entire poem. The poem is called Light. And there are about 8 stanzas of this poem, and it is believed to be inspired by Shelley's poem The Cloud. He follows the same rhythm and the same meter. Well, I'll read out to you just the last 2 stanzas, just to give you a feel of the language of the future poet, and you're just 10 years old, imagine. And it is not his native language, English, it was a foreign language. And still, here is the poem, just the last 2 stanzas. And by the way, this poem is not published in the collected volumes number 5. It has been found out much later, so I've got a Xerox for the benefit of you. Light, the last stanzas. From my sentinel, steep by the night brooded deep, I gaze with unslumbering eye. When the cynosure star of the mariner is blotted out from the sky, and guided by me through the merciless sea, though sped by the hurricane's wings, his companionless, dark, lone, weltering bark, to the haven home safely he brings. I waken the flowers in the dew-spangled bowers. This is exactly the cloud, you know, the same rhythm is there. I waken the flowers in the dew-spangled bowers, the birds in the chambers of green, and mountain and plain glow with beauty again. And they bask in the matinal sheen. Oh, if such the glad worth of my presence on earth, though fitful and fleeting the while, what glories must rest on the home of the blessed, ever bright with a deity smile. So you see, already the future Sri Aurobindo is seen in this. And imagine, the most significant thing is the first poem is called The Light. And obviously, this poet had to catch the supermental light much later. So well, we can see that later. Sometimes if you are interested, you can read that through. So you can see the mastery over the rhythm, the mastery over imagery, and already the deity is coming through him. A boy of 10 years is thinking about the deity. So you see the spiritual trends. That's why I call this creative incubation. Everything is really getting prepared. Well, after that we see that he read a lot of history, and because of which the Indian movement, the freedom of our country, he could plan it out. And very interestingly, at this time, he read a book on 6 systems of Indian philosophy. And for the first time, he comes across the word Atman, the self. And imagine, for a Western student, this new concept that the self is something that is within us, is something immortal, and that we are the self. So this really puzzles him. And yet Sri Aurobindo says that he had the mental experience in which he perceived that the self alone is real and the world is illusion. So young boy, for the first time he comes across the word self. Mentally he really says the word is mental experience. This is his own words. So he has first contact with the self on the level of the mind. So he says, I have had the mental experience of the self. And so this is again, why I'm telling you all this is, you remember these points, and each one of them gets fulfilled in the different stages of his life. And again, the other important point was, he met the famous barrister Chittaranjan Das, who would come peace into his life much later. But this is how we see the future poet is made, the future revolutionary is made, the future yogi is already seen, and then we see that this is really the seed time of Sri Aurobindo's life. So you see, there is a beautiful pattern that really unravels itself, so we can see all these things. And Sri Aurobindo, although this was the preparation of his mind for the mental stage, and he gets the highest experience of the mental stage. And in his own words, you know, when is our mind most developed? When it learns to really submit itself. When it loses its ahankara. When it loses itself saying, I am the ultimate. So this in fact is the highest mind. Is the, for spirituality, mind you, not for the scientist or for the botanist or something. But for yoga, when the mind realizes that it is not the ultimate, that is the highest stage. In Sri Aurobindo's words, he says in a different way, he says, the capital period of my intellectual development, obviously referring to the England period, confided Sri Aurobindo to a disciple, was when I could see clearly that what the intellect said might be correct, that what the intellect justified was true, and its opposite also was true. You see, this is the mature mind. I never admitted a truth in the mind without simultaneously keeping it open to the contrary of it. So how many of us can do this? It is only the acme of things that we can understand. He says, I always kept the option open that the other opinion is as much right. This is really the mind that prepares itself for the surrender to the supermind or to the higher levels of consciousness. So this in brief was the intellectual development period at England. And in spite of all this, Sri Aurobindo betrays in one of his letters that he never fell in love with England. The only European country with which he fell in love was France and not England. Although England had given him so much, he says, I was attracted to France and not to England. Well, the occult reasons you could always guess, perhaps the mother was already there in France 6 years hence in 1978. So somewhere beyond my mental understanding, there was some kind of an attraction because the mother was there and Supreme Shakti was there. However, that is only our interpretation. Now next we come to Baroda. Well, here we see, well, there was the story how he really gets the job by the Gaikwadi. And very funnily, it seems the Gaikwadi of Baroda was on a visit to England just when he had failed in his ICS exam. Well, all the stories, you know, I will not get into details how he failed or why he failed in ICS. However, he had failed in ICS, so-called failed in inverted commas. And the Gaikwad was there. So with the help of some of his friends, Sri Aurobindo met Gaikwad. And Gaikwad gave him a job. And that was for 200 rupees. And it seems later on Gaikwad told somebody that I got him very cheap. Obviously, the king could have, the Maharaja could have really paid him more. But Sri Aurobindo did not bother. You see, already he was never attached to this money. So he came to the services of the Maharaja. And when he came in 1893 and joined the Maharaja, the first work he does was join the service settlement department. Imagine, you see the significance. He starts with the survey settlement department. Well, I don't have to explain to you the meaning of that. Then he was pushed on to the revenue department. And it's only later, after about 3-4 years, that he becomes professor of English and French. And to begin with, mind you, he was a professor of French. and then only he became a professor of English. And later on, because the principal of the college went on a leave, then Sri Aurobindo was asked to become the vice principal, and very soon, within a month, become the principal. Well, that is the academic line, that Sri Aurobindo was not just an academician. There was something else that was preparing. Even externally, he started, because he had really the mission of the freedom of the country, so he started the underground movement. He started contacting people who were really working for the freedom of the country. And in order to spread his ideas, he started writing in newspaper articles. And it seems that he had even contacted some people in Rajasthan. And he tried to bring about an upheaval in the Indian army, because the Gaikwad had promised in the beginning that he would financially help him. But later on, the Maharaja withdraws. So imagine Sri Aurobindo makes a visit to Rajasthan to see some kind of uprising in the Indian army. So he was really trying to see what are the best methods to liberate the country. But this was the external facet of his life. And what was happening internally or inwardly is really phenomenal. Well, these are the four great spiritual experiences in Sri Aurobindo's life. And mind you, as I said, why I said this is the period of initiation is because he is not only initiated into the political movement and into the movement of the India's freedom, but he is initiated into spiritual life. And what were these spiritual initiations? Well, most of you know, as Sri Aurobindo relates later on, that with the very first step at Apollo Bandar in Bombay, there was this great realization of a vast calm that really comes and settles in him. He says the first spiritual experience was this. It is as if the mother India, the Bharat Mata, embraced this child of hers, this great soul of hers who would later on liberate her by giving him this gift of a vast calmness, which, as you know, is one of the pinnacles of yoga. In ancient yoga, in old yogas, this is one of the pinnacles to achieve a tremendous vast calmness. So this he got, this silence, in 1893, the very first step, maybe it was in February. And then, within 1 year, he was once going in a tanga, that is the horse carriage. And Sri Aurobindo says there was a tremendous danger of the horse carriage having an accident. And then a beautiful experience happens, which he captures in a poem. And I read out to the stanzas. Above my head, a mighty head was seen, a face with the calm of immortality, and an omnipotent gaze that held the scene in the vast circle of its sovereignty. His hair was mingled with the sun and the breeze, the world was in his heart and he was I housed in me the everlasting peace, the strength of one whose substance cannot die. He called this poem the Godhead. So this kind of a rising of the Godhead from within himself, and really becomes as huge as the vast sky, he controls the accident, he diverts his accidents. So this was the second major experience of the personal Godhead. So why I am giving these labels It is important, it's for you, it's to guide you through this personal and impersonal, because these are the major realizations you have later on. So first he has this experience of calmness, vast calmness, impersonal, and then this personal experience of the Godhead. And in 1903, it seems, Sri Aurobindo went with the Maharaja to Kashmir to spend a vacation there. But at that hill of what he calls, Sri Aurobindo calls, the ridge of Takhti Sulaiman in Kashmir, he has an experience of the vacant infinite. The vacant infinite is like the nirvanic experience. And then, well, I'll give you a little more description later on. The fourth experience, he says he had the experience of the living presence of Kali in a shrine on the banks of Narmada. So you see, these are, although in old yoga and for any common human being, this would have been almost the end of his life or the highest peak of his spiritual attainment, that he has a vision of Nirvana, of the Godhead, that he has a vision of Kali, and that he has the experience of Nirvana, and he has a vast calmness settled upon him. But still, these are four experiences only. That is why I call them the initiation. It is not yet a realization. For others it may be a realization, but for Sri Aurobindo, they were only experiences. And then, in one of his letters, we see Sri Aurobindo writing about the mission of his life, or the work of his life, and he really categorizes them into four, very clear. He says the first one is to reinterpret the Sanatana Dharma to the human intellect from a new standpoint. And so this is the great work he wanted to do. One work was to reinterpret the Sanatana Dharma, the Indian Sanatana Dharma or the Hindu or whatever is beyond all Hinduism. That's Sanatana Dharma. He says he wanted to reinterpret from a new standpoint. And mind you, he later on says that this new standpoint was revealed to him by none else than Sri Krishna himself. The new understanding that he gets into the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Gita, he says, is directly revealed by Sri Krishna himself. So this was the first work. And the second work, as he writes in that letter, is to establish a yogic sadhana which will not only liberate the soul, but prepare a perfect humanity and help in restoration of Satya Yuga. So this is the second work, to prepare a sadhana, yogic sadhana, which is not meant for the liberation or just for the mukti of the individual, but to prepare a perfect humanity. And that is the goal of Sri Aurobindo. And the third work, he says, to work for the restoration of India's place in the world, not by politics, not by arms, not by revolution, but by means of yoga, applied to human means and instruments. So he again wanted to give India back its status. Because you can imagine India's position at that time under the Britishers, under the colonial class, and what its previous and recent history had been. So he says India had lost its position, and it was Sri Aurobindo's work that he wanted to place India back on its pedestal. And the last work, he says, is a remodeling of the society to contain a new perfected humanity. So these are the four works which he himself writes, of which he himself writes in a letter to a friend. And so if we take the basis of these works, how much do we see these being initiated in Baroda? Well, as I was telling you, there is first the initiation or the into the reinterpretation of the Sanatana Dharma. That was the first work. And here Sri Aurobindo says that when he read Gita at Baroda, he sees that the interpreters had missed the distinctive nature of its teaching. Stress was on the goal, but not on action as the surest means to achieve the goal. So Sri Aurobindo says, first thing that he has to do is to give to humanity a proper understanding of the Gita. Because we all emphasized upon the goal of liberation, but the action was missed. So Sri Aurobindo decides that he has to reinterpret that. And in one of his letters he says that about the Vedas, that the Vedas are the fount of our philosophies, the bedrock of our religions, the kernel of our thought, the explanation of our ethics and society, the summary of our civilizations, the rivet of our nationality. So when you find that this is the truth about the Vedas and our Gita and Upanishads, but we have missed this truth, we have gone away into some other line, so he says, this is what I have got to reinterpret and give to humanity, the new vision. So, we see in 1903 that Sri Aurobindo turns with increasing frequency to the chief sources of Upanishads and he starts really reading them, the Vedas and the Upanishads. But we will see that Sri Krishna reveals their meaning in the next phase in Calcutta, in Alipur Jail. But I'm just seeing the initiation part of it. So first he had initiation. Then the second initiation was into the restoration of India's place. Well, here we see that he has started writing in Indu Prakash, the journal about India's new role. Because the Congress people, the Congress party at that time, was believing in only constitutional agitation. But Sri Aurobindo said that such a constitutional agitation would be like an infant crying to its nurse for a toy. He said this kind of a middle path of asking the Britishers to give us the freedom, Sri Aurobindo says, is like an infant crying to a nurse for a toy. He says we will not get it. So we will have to have some other mode. And what was the mode? He really planned it out, saying that the first work we have to do is to awaken India to the concept of total independence, for which journalism and political speeches were sufficient. To keep men's minds in a state of constant revolt, and to transform the Indian Congress and its timid demands into an extremist movement, and lastly to prepare secretly an armed revolution. And this is where I mentioned that he went even to Rajasthan to see if there could be an uprising in the Indian army. So this was the plan he put in front of the Congress or the people of India, saying that this is what we have got to do and not beg for independence. So he stood for the first time for a total independence and the extremist methods if necessary. He also began with the non-violent method. He did say this non-violent participation is a good beginning. But if necessary, we have to take to other extreme methods also. He was not a moralist. He was like Sri Krishna, who if necessary, he could bring about the Kurukshetra. But the peaceful methods have to be tried out first. But as the Lord Sri Krishna tried his best, but ultimately, when people did not accept him, Kurukshetra was inevitable. So Sri Aurobindo, being a spiritual man, he did not believe in non-violence as the ultimate method. He said it is good, but there are other methods. So spirituality does not go by good and bad. It goes by the establishment of dharma. Whatever is good for the establishment of dharma, that has to be done beyond the levels of morality. So this is the plan he had given to the country, to the nation. But maybe As we see retrospectively, the plan was a bit too much in advance. The time was not prepared. People were not ready to receive Sri Aurobindo at that time. And then we have a beautiful quotation, a beautiful letter to the countrymen, who really, he saw that, as he says, that the middle class India was really sold out to these Britishers so much that they did not take up this idea. So he writes an open letter in his Indu Prakash, which is very touching, and at the same time, why I have quoted this little longish quotation is because it really gives us a perfect image of India today on 23rd of November 1990. And this he wrote, I think, in long back in 1905 or 7. But this is exactly what India is today. And from this we can learn a few things that are really happening in our contemporary politics. So I take the liberty to read out to you a beautiful passage. He says, "Let us leave these things and look to our daily bread." You know, all these ideas which he had proposed, people were not coming forward. "Let us leave these things and look to our daily bread. This nation must perish, but let us at least and our children try to live while live we can. We are fallen and depraved, and our sins grow upon us day by day. We suffer and are oppressed, and oppression increases with every setting of the sun. We are weak and languid, and our weakness grows weaker and languor more languid every time the sun rises on the east. We are sick and broken. We are idle and cowardly. We perish every year from famine and plague. Diseases decimate us. With every decade, poverty annihilates family after family. Where there were 100 in one house, there are now 10. Where there was once a flourishing village, the leopard and the jackal will soon inhabit. God is adverse, and ourselves our worst enemies." Remember this line. "Ourselves our worst enemies. We are decaying from within and smitten from without. The sword has been taken out of our hands, and the bread is being taken out of our mouths. Worst of all, we are disunited beyond hope of union." So you see the beautiful the sentences. "We are disunited beyond the hope of union, and without union we must ere long perish." You see that situation in the country is absolutely the same. It may be 5 decades, or it may be 10, but very soon this great and ancient nation will have perished from the face of the earth, and the Negro or the Malay will inherit the homes of our fathers. I mean, this is a warning he is giving. It's not that it will happen, but if we do not have this unity and the union, that's what is going to happen. "Meanwhile, it is well that the Congress should meet once a year and deceive the country with an appearance of life. That there should be posts for the children of the soil with enough salary to keep a few from starving. That a soulless education should suck the vigor and sweetness of body and heart." He resisted. And when somebody suggested, you try. So in 1904, Sri Aurobindo tries on his own pranayama, without any guru, without anybody to help him. Just at the suggestion of a friend of his, who happened to be the disciple of Brahmananda of Gangamath. So he does this pranayama for hours together, daily, sometimes he says for 8 hours a day. And then what happens? The obvious results of pranayama are there. He has a lovely health, poetry starts streaming into him, and then he sees, he feels his body very light. But at the same time, pranayama has its own demands. That if you cannot be regular in it, then you have it. And poor Sri Aurobindo, when he goes to Calcutta, in his political life, he cannot be regular, and he becomes ill, which almost proved fatal at a time. So he has to reject it or renounce it. Well, that was the first initiation into so-called yoga. But at the same time, later on, he takes up the yoga. How? A little incident, a very common factor, a banal, you know, an incident happens. Once he was going with his brother Barindra Kumar, and his brother takes ill, he catches illness. And it's the hill fever, as it is. So he was suffering with great high temperature and was really shivering. And suddenly, a Nagasanyasin passes by. And Nagasanyasin did not know about Barindra, was not called for this. But out of the blue, so-called, this Nagasanyasin comes, he sees Barindra suffering with a great fever. He says, fetch me a glass of water. And a glass of water is brought. So Nagasanyasin crosses that water with a finger just like that. And he utters the mantra and he says to Barindra, take this water. And Sri Aurobindo is witnessing all this, mind you. And when Barindra takes this water, within a couple of minutes, is back on his feet, all the fever gone. So for once, Sri Aurobindo sees and witnesses the power of yoga. And what he wanted was this power. But not for himself, mind you. Because as I said, he was looking for some way to liberate the country. Because his articles and writings and speeches were falling on deaf ears. So he said, let us contact some kind, some higher power which can really translate this this freedom of the country into a reality. So you see that yoga could give this lever of power. So this is what initially attracts him, not for any mukti or liberation. So he says, okay, let me try that. sorry. So he writes, the agnostic was in me, the atheist was in me, the skeptic was in me, and I was not absolutely sure that there was a God at all. Imagine Sri Aurobindo writing this. But this is the beauty of his life, his paradoxes, you know. This really also gives us some hope. He says, I was not absolutely sure that there was a God at all. I felt there must be a mighty truth somewhere in this yoga. So when I turned to the yoga and resolved to practice it and find out if my idea was right, I did it in this spirit and with this prayer to him. And listen to this most beautiful prayer. If thou art, then thou knowest my heart. Thou knowest that I do not ask for mukti. I do not ask for anything which others ask for. I ask only for strength to uplift this nation. I ask only to be allowed to live and work for this people whom I love. So you see, this was the beginning of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. And because he tells umpteen times later on that I did not want any power, I did not want the supermind, I did not want the divine realization for myself, I do not require any of this. If at all I am realizing, I am trying to realize all this, it is for this humanity whom I love. Why I am emphasizing this is because there are a lot of people who ask us the question, what is Sri Aurobindo doing, what has Sri Aurobindo done for humanity? Because we feel that service of humanity is the highest thing that what our old religions have taught us. But whereas Sri Aurobindo does not really believe in the service of humanity for itself. So there is a question. It says, how do we understand? But here you see the first prayer from Sri Aurobindo is that he wants this higher power only to be able to serve this humanity or to uplift this. So this, with this prayer, he says he started doing yoga. And, well, this is the first initiation. I will not go further, we'll come back to it again. I'm just trying to keep up our different periods. Now this was the beginning of yoga. But at the same time, Sri Aurobindo had begun discovering what later on in his philosophy becomes very important, the levels within man, the levels below mind. Because man is not just a human being with body and mind and soul. Sri Aurobindo for the first time discovered that there are different levels and layers. Well, obviously, our ancient yogas have also given lot of these levels, the sukshma shariras, what they call, are there. I do not deny that. But here Sri Aurobindo discovers in a different way, and this is where his contribution comes to yoga. Well, very much in brief, because most of you who are already delved with Sri Aurobindo know these things, and I will not delve in deep, because I have also time limit here. The first one, well, here, in Sri Aurobindo's own words, he discovers the levels below mind. And what they are, he says, my own life and my yoga have always been, since my coming to India, both this worldly and otherworldly, without any exclusiveness on either side. All human interests are, I suppose, this worldly, and most of them have entered into my mental field, and some like politics into my life. But at the same time, since I set foot on the Apollo Bandar in Bombay, I began to have spiritual experiences, but these were not divorced from this world, but had an inner and infinite bearing on it, such as a feeling of the infinite pervading material space and the immanent inhabiting material objects and bodies. At the same time, this is what I wanted to point out, I found myself entering supra-physical worlds and planes with influences and an effect from them upon the material plane. So I could make no sharp divorce or irreconcilable opposition between what I have called the two ends of existence and all that lies between them. So this is, right from the beginning you see the emphasis of Sri Aurobindo that there is no difference between the inner and the outer. That there cannot be any divorce between the inner life and the outer life. And this he has shown us in a practical manner. And that's what I am trying to emphasize today. That with all this external life which I am giving you, we see that there is a parallel inner life. And so along with this four experiences and the beginning of yoga, the first thing he does is trying at silencing the mind. Well, that will come to it later, how he started doing that. But this is a process of yoga which we'll discuss tomorrow when we discuss the integral yoga. But he says, when he started trying to silence the mind, he concentrated upon an image of vastness, of a vast ocean, and really upon an image of the Supreme Lord, because there are different methods, and we'll discuss that later. But why I'm saying this, he says, it is by this method He says, it was in this last way that I myself came by the mind silence, unimaginable to me before I had its actual experience. That means by the method of trying to see this image of the Lord within himself, concentrating upon the image of the Lord. Well, this was the beginning of silencing the mind. Sri Aurobindo says, when he silenced the mind, he found that there are within human beings certain centers of consciousness which our ancient tantras have really described to us. They are the chakras. But mind you, why this is not a book reading that Sri Aurobindo is doing. He is rediscovering all this within himself, by himself. It is not, there's no tantric yogi to tell him what to do. So he says that I have discovered these chakras, the ancient tantric chakras. So there was this discovery. He says, on the superconscious level, there is the Sahasrara, the thousand petal lotus. And then on the mental level, there are three centers. One in the eyebrows, which all of you know is the vision. The throat is the speech. And then we have one. No, then the vital level is shown. This is on the mental, there are two. On the vital level, there are three. One is the heart level, the navel, which is full of possession and ambition, and the level between the navel and the sex center, which is full of jealousy and envy and desire, and the last is the physical. But here I may add a note that Sri Aurobindo did not discover only seven centers. Later on in his yoga practices in Pondicherry, he discovers that there are 12 centers in man, not seven. So seven are these traditional seven. So he finds there are three below, one in the knees, the other in the foot, the other below the feet. That is what he calls the subconscious and the inconscious centers. And two centers above the head, the overmental and the supermental. So in all, there are 12 centers ranging. And this is where Sri Aurobindo has made a new contribution again with the old Tantra Yoga. Well, coming back to our thing. So he says, so when you silence the mind, you discover these things. And then he discovered there is something called the vital being within us, the prana sharira, which is full of its own life energy, which is full of its own desires. And then ultimately, he questions himself, but look, when I silence the mind, my mind is not mine. The thoughts that we think are not ours. But there is a universal level of thought. And these thoughts really come into you, they flood you, they really, like a marketplace, they come into your being. So our mind is only a marketplace for these wayfarers of thoughts to come in. So he says, what is my mind? I don't have a mind. And the life itself, he says, the emotions, the desires, the passions are not within you. They also come from outside. So Sri Aurobindo says, then who am I? What is this place? What is this idea of I? Then there is the discovery of the deep psychic being, or the soul, or the Atma. And how to realize that, is again a part of integral yoga. We'll discuss later. Well, for our purpose, for the present, we see that in Baroda, Sri Aurobindo was initiated into all the four work that he had to do, the spiritual, the yoga, and the nation level. So he had done all the initiations, and then is the third phase of his life, that of realization, that is the Calcutta. Well, in Calcutta, we see externally he was engaged as a principal of the National College. And here also, as once I mentioned to you, when Maharaja called him for 200 rupees, so similarly, when he came to the National College, he had lost half his salary. As a principal, he was drawing much more. But money never bothered him. Even the money that he was getting in Baroda, what did he do? No luxury. He bought as it is said, cartons of books, cartloads of books, and he used to read the books. So all his money he used to spend on books and books. How ironic. Well, there also there is an interesting narration of his life. We will not get into that. Well, he comes to Calcutta as an extern, as he gets involved in the college. And then there he sees that the time was preparing itself. Because in, remember in 1905 there was a famous partition of Bengal, and that had really blasted the whole situation. And there was a sense of revolt had come in to Bengal. And that was the proper time for Sri Aurobindo to strike. All that he was trying to do in Baroda was coming to fulfillment now. So he says, at that time, the repressive movement in Bengal was the right period. So in 1906, on 15th of August, the National College was opened with him as the principal. And later on he started the Bande Mataram and the Juvanta, of which he was the de facto editor. And he was running this, writing his fiery articles in the Bande Mataram. In 1907, there is an interesting anecdote by a correspondent of Manchester Guardian who interviewed Sri Aurobindo in 1907 and writes a beautiful little description of Sri Aurobindo. He says, grave with intensity, careless of faith or opinion, and one of the most silent men I have known. He was of the stuff that dreamers are made of. But dreams who will act their dream, dreamers who will act their dream, indifferent to the means. So here you see, imagine a correspondent is writing, a British correspondent, writing of Sri Aurobindo. So you see, in the thick of politics, what is it that gray with intensity, careless of faith or opinion? And he was one of the most silent men. So he was working silently. Well, the famous incident of the Surat Congress in December 1907, Sri Aurobindo goes to attend. From Calcutta he goes to Surat. And that, as all of you know, was the real change in Indian politics. And the whole movement really began, the movement of freedom, independence. Well, there also, as some of you have must have read, that it is Sri Aurobindo who really gave the call for the breakup of the moderates and the extremists, and the extremists took over. So that was a different political story. I don't know, a lot of our youngsters do not know about this Sri Aurobindo's involvement in Congress, but that is a period gone. The truth has been come out. So why I am saying about this is that he came to Surat for this national for this Congress. It was something else. At this time, Varendra contacts a yogi, a Maharashtrian yogi, and he says, he calls Sri Aurobindo that he should meet Maharashtrian yogi, who was Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, and he tells Sri Aurobindo that you really take initiation from him. But Sri Aurobindo, as we have seen, he had just started in 1904 his pranayama, he had got some results, and he wanted to start his yoga because if he could get some power after seeing the Nagasanyasa. And then he was trying out certain things within himself, and he says, you are blocked somewhere. So this Varendra's suggestion that why don't you take the help of Maharashtra yogi Lele, Sri Aurobindo says, okay, let's try. So this meeting at Congress was the external cause of the internal thing that takes place in Sri Aurobindo's life. So when Lele meets Sri Aurobindo, Lele takes Sri Aurobindo to a private house, and there he says that he is ready to initiate him. But the first thing that Sri Aurobindo says is, I want to do yoga, but for work, for action,
not for sannyasa or for nirvana. So he tells his would-be guide and guru that if you want me to do yoga, I am ready to do, but not for sannyasa and nirvana. Then Lele says, it won't be a problem because you have been already a poet. It's a very significant comment. I don't know, we may have to think about it later. Why Lele said, because you are already a poet, it will be easy for you to do yoga. So there is some connection, maybe we'll think over it. Then Lele agrees that he will give him a yoga for action. And here, Sri Aurobindo very beautifully describes his first meeting with Lele, what happened. Lele says, sit in meditation, but do not think. Look only at your mind. You will see thoughts coming into it. Before they can enter, throw this away from your mind till your mind is capable of entire silence. Sri Aurobindo says, I have never heard before a thought coming visibly into the mind from outside, but I did not think either of questioning the truth or the possibility. You see, this wonderful attitude of Sri Aurobindo had already experienced the four basic experiences, realizations, who had already done a lot of pranayama, who had already gone advanced in his yoga. But he says, I did not question. So this is the kind of a surrender of the shishya to the guru. No question. So he says, so I simply sat down and as a wonderful disciple and did it. In a moment my mind became silent as a windless air on a high mountain summit, and then I saw one thought and then another coming in a concrete way from outside. I flung them away before they could enter and take hold of the brain, and in 3 days I was free. So this is the first experience. Well, as a result of this silencing of the mind, what happens? The first great experience of Sri Aurobindo comes. Remember, I'm making the difference between realizations, the four realizations of which we talked of, but now is the first great spiritual experience. And I cannot do anything better than to quote Sri Aurobindo. In the concrete consciousness of stillness and silence that had completely replaced his sense of self, there arose the awareness of some soul and supreme reality, what he would later identify as the passive Brahman. This experience was attended at first by an overwhelming feeling and perception of the total unreality of the world. So this is, as he has himself used the word, passive Brahman. It is a kind of a nirvanic experience. So he served in those first spiritual experience was that of the passive Brahman. That's what we also call as the nirvana. But Sri Aurobindo was not a person who would be satisfied with the realization of nirvana. Because nirvana is actually, it's like crossing from one ignorance, crossing from this ignorance. But if we stop at that, it's like going from one place, you stand on the bridge, and then if you think that that bridge is the ultimate, we are making a mistake. Nirvana, as Sri Aurobindo says, is only an intermediary stage to cross from this ignorance into the supreme reality. But most of the people in the old yoga thought that nirvana is the ultimate realization. Sri Aurobindo says, no, it's only a bridge. You come onto the bridge, and he says you must go across and cross the other, go to the other side of the bridge. Then only you will see what is the other side. So Sri Aurobindo did not stop at this stage of nirvana. Even Vivekananda describes it as saying, an ocean of infinite peace without a ripple, without a breath. So this being beautiful, this experience being this rippleless, most of the people thought, or most of the yogis, not people who have attended, that this is the ultimate. And so Sri Aurobindo says, no, this is not the ultimate. So he went further. But when he was there for months together, as he says, in the state of nirvana, it is not that he stopped his activities. He was writing, he was talking, he was going to the political activities. But in Bombay he gave the first public lecture after attending, because he was still in Surat, remember. It was on 30th of December that 1907 he met Lele and he had this experience. He was still in Gujarat, and he was called for a public talk in Bombay. And Sri Aurobindo tells Lele, look, I cannot speak, because my mind is not thinking, it is absolutely in the passive Dhamma. Then Lele says, he encourages him. He says, Sri Aurobindo says, he, that is Lele, asked me to pray, but I was so absorbed in the silent Brahman consciousness that I could not pray. He replied that it didn't matter. He and some others would pray, and I had simply to go to the meeting and make namaskar to the audience as Narayan, and wait, and speech would come to me from some other source than the mind. So imagine, this was his state. Sri Aurobindo did exactly as he was told, and the speech came as though it were dictated. And ever since, all speech, writing, thought and outward activity have so come to me from the same source, from the brain mind, same source above the brain mind. So you see, this is what the ancient tradition we thought, we may be thinking that once we are in the silence of the mind, how do we act in this world? That we have to withdraw into some kind of a non-existent world. But Sri Aurobindo says, no. It is from that same silent world he started. You see the word speech, writing, thought and all outward activity. So there can still be the possibility of action even while you are in nirvana. One doesn't have to really withdraw from this world and its life. So this was the beginning of all his activities, that he says, from the nirvanic mind, silent of the Brahman, he got it. And then we have, so he comes back after that great experience in Surat, the first experience of the passive Brahman. And when he comes back, before leaving Surat, he asks Lele for an advice, because he is leaving the Guru, and he says, what is the advice you impart? And Lele says, can you really contact your inner guide? Sri Aurobindo says, yes. He says, that is what is important. You contact your inner guide and that is sufficient. So Sri Aurobindo takes Lele's guidance and comes back to Calcutta. Again back into his political life. And it seems that after a few months Lele comes to Calcutta on some purpose and work, and he meets Sri Aurobindo and asks him the question, are you continuing with your meditations? And Sri Aurobindo says, no. And Lele gets a little disturbed and he says, well, you are taken up by the devil. So he was a little disappointed in Sri Aurobindo, saying that if you have stopped your meditations, but Lele did not know what Sri Aurobindo was undergoing, that he was really in the state of the static Brahman or the Nirvana. So Sri Aurobindo chuckles and keeps quiet. He is not a person to really argue it out or explain his position. But however, he started back in his political life. And as you know, on 4th of May 1908, when Sri Aurobindo was just the age of 36, a young man, the Britishers clamped him into the jail. Well, that is a story, part of the history. But what is interesting to us is that he is put into the jail. But why? As I am telling, as we are trying to see that every incident, instance, circumstance in Sri Aurobindo has led him deeper and deeper. And he writes in his book Kara Kahini, The Tales of Prison Life, that a month before going to jail, he did receive a call from his inside saying, withdraw from this active life and get into some kind of a seclusion so that you may realize what the Lord wants you to do. But Sri Aurobindo says, my work was very dear to me, and in the pride of my heart I thought that unless I was there, it would suffer or even fail and ease, therefore I would not leave it. You see, Sri Aurobindo was sort of getting attached to the work, and he even felt that without his presence the work might suffer. So he so-called disobeys the inner call, and this is why he is thrown into the prison. If that is the ashram, that is the place of his yoga, where Sri Krishna tells him later, the bonds you had not the strength to break, I have broken for you. Because it is not my will, nor was it ever my intention, that should continue. I have had another thing for you to do, and it is for that I have brought you here, to teach you what you could not learn for yourself, and to train you for my work. So Sri Krishna was the man behind, was the person behind, to pull Sri Aurobindo out of this activity and put him into the jail. Because under those circumstances, very ironically, I think the British prison, and that too a cell in which Sri Aurobindo was put, a cell of isolation, that was the greatest seclusion for a perfect realization of the Supreme. So very ironically, Sri Aurobindo was thrust into the jail behind the bars, but those bars were not his prison, because those bars of prison life bring to him the greatest freedom. As we see, what is the work that Sri Krishna says? The twofold. One was the realization of the active Brahman, or the cosmic consciousness, as we'll give you a description. And then the other was Sri Aurobindo started delving into the levels beyond mind. So remember, these are again the two activities, like he had in Baroda, the levels below mind. Now he discovers the levels beyond mind, the superconscious levels. And then, the first is the cosmic consciousness, the realization of the cosmic consciousness, and where we have, most of you must have read, a beautiful description of how he sees Vasudeva, Narayana, everywhere. And this case lasted long, with about 200 witnesses and 4,000 files. But Sri Aurobindo was not disturbed. And there's a very small incident, very interesting. In the jail, it seems, when he was there, some of his colleagues planned to escape altogether. They had even planned and caught some other outside influence, and they wanted to escape from the jail. So everything was ready. But of course, even then they had to ask Sri Aurobindo. And they went and asked Sri Aurobindo that plans are ready, shall you all go? Sri Aurobindo says, no, I will not go. Of course, when he said no, the whole plan fell through and nobody went out. Obviously, if they had attempted anything, most of these people would have been in Andamans. But Sri Aurobindo knew the future, what is going to happen. And Sri Aurobindo knew, not only the future, but Sri Krishna says, you are here and I am taking care of you, so you don't have to bother. So he had completely surrendered to Sri Krishna, and he could not take any decision. And what was the surrender? He has the description here. of the cosmic consciousness. He says, I looked at the jail that secluded me from men, and it was no longer by its high walls that I was imprisoned. No, it was Vasudeva who surrounded me. I walked under the branches of the tree in front of my cell, but it was not the tree. I knew it was Vasudeva. It was Sri Krishna whom I saw standing there and holding over me his shade. I looked at the bars of my cell, the very grating that did duty for a door, and again I saw Vasudeva. It was Narayana who was guarding and standing sentry over me. Or I lay on the coarse blankets that were given me for a couch, and I felt the arms of Sri Krishna around me, the arms of my friend and lover. I looked at the prisoners in the jail, the thieves, the murderers, the swindlers, and as I looked at them, I saw Vasudeva. It was Narayana whom I found in these darkened souls and misused bodies. So this was the second great spiritual experience, the cosmic Brahman, the cosmic consciousness or the active Brahman. So this is the second, you see why I am saying second and third, there is the ascent from one to the other. And now we go to the second part of the work. This was the first thing that Sri Krishna had promised him, and that he would really give him a work, and that was the realization of his own cosmic self. And the second one, as I said, was the discovery of the superconscient levels. Well, there again a unique contribution of Sri Aurobindo, that what are the levels behind and beyond the mind? Well, we must be clear of one thing, that these levels exist independent of what we think or feel. They are a level and a layer that are independently existing. Well, whatever, these levels, as we saw yesterday, from the involutionary point, were supermind, overmind, etc. But Sri Aurobindo discovered from below upwards, and he says, beyond mind, what is there? He says, the first one is the higher mind. I'll give a very brief description, because I'll not get into details. The higher mind, he says, is a luminous thinking. That means here knowledge is born directly. You don't have to go through logic and through reasoning and all that. You have a direct knowledge. The higher level is the illumined mind, where you get the luminous seeing of truth. That means there is a vision, that the truth is not heard, the truth is seen. So you have great poetry on that level. And then third level is the intuitive mind. It is the direct light of the spirit that sees and hears or discerns the truth by swift revealing thought. And the last one is the overmind, which is a cosmic consciousness, and which, as Sri Aurobindo says, if you get that, your ego is dissolved, and then you live in a perfect peace and joy, because that is the borderline of ignorance, of avidya. Well, I've taken you very much in a hurry, but this was the route, the path that was chalked out to him. And behind this, Sri Aurobindo says, it was Sri Ramakrishna who himself came personally and turned him onto this yoga. And again he says, it was Swami Vivekananda who gave the foundations of the knowledge of the new yoga. And again, as you saw, it was Sri Krishna himself who brought him here to give him this Vishwadarshana, this cosmic consciousness. So for him, Sri Aurobindo, the jail was a place of realization. So these were the realizations that we see at Calcutta. So again, he comes out of the prison after 1 year. He starts a new magazine called the Karma Yogin. But slowly, he gets into the outer political world, where most of the leaders have been put away in Andamans, or some of the leaders have been killed. So there is a politically the field is really empty. So he starts karma yoga. But within himself, there is the problem. He has realized on one side the nirvana, and the other side the cosmic Brahman, or the active Brahman and the passive Brahman. But Sri Aurobindo, for once he says, how can there be that there are these two different aspects? There must be something missing between them. How can two hands exist independently, left hand and the right hand? They must belong to a person. So these left hand and the right hand become the poises or the aspects of one single person. But he could not get the link. You see, this is all thinking today is easy. But for that dynamic yogi who got the experiences individually, and he saw the levels are there, different levels, but the contact is still missing. So while he was working on this, suddenly there is a call from within, and he is asked to go to Chandanagar. One day he was sitting in the Karma Yogin office, and he gets an adesh, go to Chandanagar. And as he was, within 10 minutes, he walks straight from the office to a ghat, takes a boat and goes to Chandanagar. So within 10 minutes, he leaves Calcutta and is on the way to Chandanagar. And Chandanagar, he stays from February 1910 to 31st March 1910, just 2 months. But why did he go to Chandanagar? Again, as he was in the prison cell, he realized something. In Chandanagar was the third realization. There, we have seen till now that Sri Aurobindo had reached a higher level of the overmind. He had reached that level. But in Sri Aurobindo, this is the unique thing. He says that the more one approaches the summit, the more one touches the depths. And there's a line in Savitri which says, none can reach heaven who has not passed through hell. So that means there is a kind of a descent into the matter, into subconscious level. You cannot just keep on going. Well, other yogis have done, I don't say they have not done. But Sri Aurobindo, he was not interested in just finding the active or the passive Brahman. He had already realized it. So he says, in Chandanagar, these 2 months, he was again complete, he was in complete isolation. And there, he delves into the subconscious levels. So you see the three phases. Baroda was just below the mind, Calcutta above the mind, and Chandanagar below even the physical level, which is called the subconscious level. So he gets into the subconscious level, where he sees there are different subconscious levels, of which we discussed in our last lecture of the physical transformation, that there is a mental subconscious, the vital subconscious, and the physical subconscious. Well, he goes through all these levels, and then he finds at the bottom something called the inconscient. Remember yesterday's talk, the lowest depth that the Supreme had come was the inconscient. And Sri Aurobindo, in Chandanagar, reaches this level of the inconscient, or as the Vedas call, the infinite rock. When there, the experiences were harrowing. It is not pleasant. You can imagine even in a bad dream, if you get what troubles you get, a bad dream. But so if you get into the universal subconscious, he was harrowed, and it was a great torture and a suffering. However, when he gets into the inconscient, he says, there is a line in a poem called The God's Labor. He describes this labor of inconscient. He says, I have been digging deep and long, mid a horror of filth and mire. A voice cried, go where none have gone, dig deeper and deeper yet, till thou reach the grim foundation stone and knock at the keyless gate. Well, this was the description of the inconscient. This is a long description. But he reaches, as he says, the inconscient level, and he knocks at this gate as he's told. And there happens the great miracle. He says the moment he knocked and he got to this level, he suddenly sees an immense light, which later he recognizes as supermind. Yesterday we were telling that the highest supermind, when it comes down and comes down and comes down into the inconscient and keeps itself there, it is hidden. The sun that is hidden in the caverns, that is in the Vedas. So that is the bright sun at the bottom of matter also. So Sri Aurobindo, he reaches that, and in a beautiful sentence in Savitri he says, a fathomless seal astonishment of light. You know, this great surprise of the great light, L capital. And then, there is a beautiful description, similar description by the mother. Later on she says, at the very bottom of the inconscience, most hard and rigid and narrow and stifling, I struck upon an almighty spring that cast me up forthwith into a formless, limitless, vast, vibrating with the seeds of a new world. You see, there's a similar experience. Mother also goes into the inconscient and she sees the same light promising of the new world and which we saw yesterday for the supermental world. So Sri Aurobindo had got this link between the passive Brahman and the active Brahman. He says the link is the supermind. So with the realization of the link, he knew who the person was, the supreme Brahman. So this is the third spiritual experience, that of this spiritual supreme Brahman. And he realizes it is that Brahman of whom this active and the passive are two aspects. But otherwise, it is the supreme absolute is there. Because he had to find this link. And this link is the supermind. So well, with our story, we come to the end of Chandanagar, and after 2 months, he gets again an adesh, go to Pondicherry. And again, in a beautiful manner, he comes to Pondicherry on 4th of April, 4 p.m., 1910, he reaches Pondicherry. Well, there is a story how he has reached, and all is very interesting. You may read his biography. Well, at Pondicherry, there is, as we said, this is the stage of the fulfillment or the manifestation.